This Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. For more than 30 years, the standard in the rare coin grading industry. To learn more, visit www.pcgs.com. Bill Ekberg, president of the EAC, drops by this week for the Coin Week podcast. We talk important first coins, ultimate collections, and things you might want to avoid when buying large cents and half cents and certified holders. Hi, Bill. Thanks for joining me on the Coin Week podcast.
I'm happy to be here. Good to talk to you, Charles.
So, Bill, one of the things I wanted to reach out and talk to you about, you know, we've done quite a few videos together on different copper topics, from the intricacies of grading copper coins to proper preservation techniques. You can see these videos on our popular YouTube channel if you haven't checked them out already. But I wanted to talk to you today about copper coins that come into the market and maybe in certified holders, maybe raw. But what should collectors look for in these coins that, in your opinion, would make you want to avoid them?
Things to avoid. Well, okay. The first thing that you should do is, I would actually turn that around a little bit. I think the first thing you should do is learn how to recognize quality in copper coins. You should look at the color. The color, unless it's a high-end uncirculated coin, should be a nice light brown. If it's really dark, that's a suggestion that somebody has messed with it at some point. If it's pink, it's been dipped, and that's been messed with. But if you want to look, what you really want to look for is nice color. The other problem that early copper coins have that you really can't see in a holder is little edge bumps. There are collectors who really, really are disturbed by edge bumps on coppers, and the holders from the third-party graders generally hide those. So if you buy one in the slab, you can't really tell if that's been done.
Explain what an edge bump is for people who might not be familiar with that terminology.
Yeah, any coin that gets circulated is going to get little nicks on it and scratches and that kind of thing. Large cents in particular are very heavy, and which is part of the reason that they got rid of them. And when they would fall against something, and they would just get a real, sometimes a very deep nick in the edge of the coin. Sometimes that shows in the dentals on the front of the back, in which case it's really bad. Sometimes it's just on the edge, and it's a very, very common situation. Even some very high-grade early coppers have these. And there are collectors who just won't touch a coin that's got edge bumps. There are collectors who don't mind them. You do have to evaluate the coin for things like that. The other thing you want to look for is if there's a smooth planchet. The third-party graders are inconsistent in whether they will or how they will deal with a coin that's got some porosity. That means it's had some corrosion that has been removed. Sometimes they just give those a details grade. Sometimes they give it a straight grade, and you have to look. You can't absolutely trust what somebody else tells you about any coin, and that's true. Not just of coins in slabs, that's true of any coin that you're getting anywhere. You really have to trust your own eye.
One of the things that I see quite frequently that would disturb me if I was paying a significant sum of money for a coin are signs of active or inactive corrosion. If you saw a coin that you otherwise liked, but it had, you know, some sort of corrosive sign, red spots, green spots, would that dissuade you from buying the coin? Or do you feel that, you know, for some coins, this is just a fact of life. You know, these are old coins. They were not necessarily treated well when they were used in the first place.
It's not something that you need to expect of a copper coin of that age. I think it's a very good question, though. There are ways to remove it if it's really green corrosion or red corrosion or whatever color it is, what it's doing is eating into the surface of the coin. It's just like rust. And it'll continue to do so unless you stop it. And the only way you can stop it is to remove it. There are techniques for that. People have used rose thorns to pick it off. I've never done that myself. I don't really know how well that works, but I know people who swear by it and do it all the time. You can sometimes dissolve it off with chemicals. You have to be very careful using chemicals on coins, but if you are a good chemist, you can figure out how some things that would work. But the key is to just neutralize it, keep it from oxidizing the coin further. One thing that people used to do is coat the coin with wax or lacquer. That keeps air away from it, and that'll keep it from corroding further, I think. And anything that you can do that keeps air and moisture away from it will at least slow down corrosion. And that's the best thing you can do with any copper coin is keep it away from air and water.
So with copper coins, and I think it's imperative that all collectors know this, because, you know, copper is so reactive to the environment that copper coins are always in a state of change.
That's right.
And, you know, when you have a coin in a holder, you know, the holder itself may protect a coin from many types of harm, but it doesn't stop a coin from changing.
That's absolutely correct. They're not airproof. They're not waterproof. So certainly the color of a coin can change in the slab, for sure.
Another thing that people should understand, coins are not born in slabs.
That's for sure.
So when you see a half cent or a large cent in a certified holder, you have to know that that coin has been in the raw or in the wild for most of its life. Also, there's a pretty good chance that that coin is going to be cracked out and put out in the open air again, where it'll be exposed to the elements. And that knowledgeable collectors of the series know that proper care and preservation has to be part of that coin's diet if there's any hope of keeping it for the long term in the condition that it was in when they bought it.
Absolutely. And that, in fact, is one reason that many copper collectors crack their coins out of slabs. If a copper coin has, you know, fully brown surfaces, no trace of corrosion, but definitely fully brown and even color and so on, it probably doesn't hurt it to remain in a slab. But if a copper coin has some red color, there's always little dust specks in the slab that are going to get on it, that are going to cause it to corrode. I would not leave a coin in a slab for long-term storage, unless there was a really, really, really good reason to do it. What most of us do is crack them out, and we put them in these little cotton liners that fit in a 2x2 envelope and store them that way. And copper coins have been stored that way for many, many, many years without changing significantly. If we're really paranoid, like I am, about our copper coins changing, what I do is I put them in a little polyethylene bag. You can buy these polyethylene bags at major coin shows. They're very cheap. Polyethylene is chemically inert, so it does not interact with the coin. And it's unlike PVC, and it's very, very soft, so it doesn't scratch the coin, unlike Mylar. And you can fold that polyethylene bag over it, and the coin is now in something that's airtight. You put it in the little cotton liner, and you put that in your 2x2 envelope. And I think that's the very safest way that you can store a copper coin.
Do you have a good source for these polyethylene bags?
Not really. There are several dealers that set up at major coin shows that have them. I'm sure Wizard Coin Supply has them. I'm not looking at their website right now, but I'm sure they do. There are even dealers at local coin shows frequently that have those. They're not hard to get. The cotton liners are harder to get because they have to be handmade, and there are a couple of dealers in Early American Coppers who sell them. But otherwise, those are a little more challenging to get.
A question I get sometimes from collectors who get concerned about the effects of the environment on copper coins come from collectors from coastal areas or humid areas like Florida or Louisiana. Are these safe regions to collect and store copper coins?
Well, first of all, I hope that it's a good idea to do it because I live in Florida. I live in Florida, not far from the coast. So I'm obviously not afraid to collect nice copper coins here. There are several other very serious collectors of copper coins in Southeast Florida. So you just have to pay attention to them. You just have to take care of them and do what you should do to take care of them, and they're fine here. You don't want to dip them in salt water, but you wouldn't do that anyhow.
When it comes to the registry set scene, since so many of the EAC specialist collectors are cracking their coins out once they get them for their personal collections, do you feel that the registry set subset of collectors, when you're looking at these rankings that you see online, do you feel at the high end that those rankings mirror the best sets that are being assembled? Or do you think the types of sets and the number of collectors building them in no way illustrates how popular copper coins are at the present time?
I would say the registry set collecting, by PCGS and NGC and so on, I would say that is definitely not much of a representation of what high-end collecting in EAC is. There are very few early copper collectors who keep all of their coins in slabs. I know one of the collectors of one of the very, very best collections of half cents, I don't think he has any of his coins in slabs. The Missouri cabinet was never slabbed until right before it was sold. In fact, many copper dealers do that. They keep their coins raw, and then when they're going to be sold at auction, the auction company has them slabbed. So I would say that most of the best copper collections would not be in the PCGS and NGC set registries.
So by that logic, is it fair to assume that the population reports that are published by both companies is likely in no way representative of what the best known coins of each issue are in terms of what specialist collectors might call a condition census?
I agree completely with that. In fact, that's one of the things about early American coppers is that we actually invented the concept of condition census, and EAC, at least for large sets, there are a couple of members of the club who actually have looked at almost all of the high-grade coins of every variety and actually maintain a condition census that includes the coins that are in slabs and that includes the coins that are not in slabs. It includes the coins that you and I will probably never see. And so their condition censuses are far more accurate than what PCGS and NGC would say. It's also important to keep in mind that PCGS and NGC are grading coins a different way than EAC does. They're grading based on what they think the market value is, and we are grading based on how well the coin is preserved since it was made. And those are two really quite different things.
There have been several major collections that have entered the market in recent years. And in this industry and amongst collectors, it seems like there's this age-old yet always present concern that our hobby is not moving along on all four cylinders, that we're not doing enough to replenish the hobby with new blood as older collectors divest themselves of their coins. Yet, you see auction after auction, vast sums of money are still being spent acquiring coins. So do you share that concern that others might have regarding the future of this hobby?
Early copper coins are the very first coins that were consciously collected in America. And that happened because back in government called them all in and released these small Flying Eagle cents or nickels, as they were called at the time. People have therefore been studying particularly large cents ever since 1857. And there's a huge literature on them. The literature is growing all the time now. It's a very, very active field of study. The coins are very, very charming. They were the money of the people. And I think people understand that. When you talk about coins being history in your hands, these are the real coins that were history in your hands and always will be. As you said, early coppers, early American copper, club membership is not decreasing. It's actually a little bit larger than it was last year, and I think it was a little larger last year than the year before. So unlike most coin clubs, our membership is at least stable and probably growing a little bit. And I think that's a good sign for coin collecting in general, because if there is such a thing as a collector coin, early copper is it. There's so much to learn, so much to study. And the other thing about it is that people don't just come in with a bunch of money, buy a set, simply because you can't buy a set in one day, and then tire of it and sell it off like they do with a lot of things. Once you get into copper, there's so much to study, there's so much that's interesting, that it tends to stick with people for a very long time. We do have a few people who come in, throw money at coins, and then get out. We call them comets. But they're really quite rare in early copper. People that get into this generally tend to stick with it, join the club, they meet each other, they find that, you know, other people that collect these things are interesting too, and it becomes a community. Eventually, in fact, with a lot of people, the coins cease to be the most important thing, but the knowledge that you learn and the friends that you make tend to become more and more important as you go along. So I'm not really concerned about the future of EAC, certainly not in the next few decades. Who knows what's going to happen in 50 years. But for now, I'm not worried about the health of EAC.
How's the hobby doing with carrying forward the type of hard-earned specialized knowledge that our forebears worked so hard to achieve? I know coins are much more expensive now, and the ability we might have to do extensive study has changed somewhat. But some might say that the internet has made it easier at the same time. But I wonder sometimes, as busy as we are in our real lives, do collectors today really have the time to learn about coins the way hobbyists in the past did? Certainly the hobby has made great strides in making collecting easier, but is it making collectors more knowledgeable?
You know, I don't really think it's that different. I think EAC has always been a club for people who really like to learn about their coins, who people really like to study them, who really like to get into it. You don't have to be buying high-end coins. We've been talking mostly about high-end coins this morning, but you don't really have to be buying high-end coins to get really into them and to study them and understand them. We have people that that study low-end coins and end up with very, very interesting projects as well. There's so much that's available, so much that you can do. It really becomes a lifelong interest. I would also say that early copper is not something that you can, obviously something you can collect out of change. So you can't fill a penny board of half cents or anything from what you spend. It's something that people tend to get into in midlife when they have, you know, pretty good disposable income, or at least some disposable income. We do have several specialist dealers in the club who are under 35 years old. So I think that the future is good. I think the future is very good for the club.
Given the high-quality collections that we've seen come to market in recent years, and based on your knowledge of what's out there at the upper range of quality, how close do you think we've come to seeing the ultimate copper collection?
Wow, how close we're coming to seeing the ultimate copper collection. Well, there are two collections that have come on the market in the last decade three, depending on how you define it, that are probably as ultimate as anybody's going to do. If you want to talk about a collection of that's just outstanding quality, but not complete, the Pogue collection would be that. That's primarily a sort of a Red Book variety set, but all of the coins are in superb condition, and so it's a very, very high quality set. If you want completeness, the Dan Holmes sale, which was back in 2009, I think, had every variety of large cent that is known except two, and one of those is in the collection of the American Numismatic Society, and they actually loaned it out so that it could be viewed at lot viewing for the Holmes sale of those. And one other coin that's only known by one example, and the guy wouldn't sell it to Dan Holmes, which I think is kind of strange. I would certainly have sold it to him with the understanding that I got first refusal when he sold the collection back. And as far as a combination of completeness and quality, I don't think anyone will ever suppress the Missouri Cabinet Collection in any series of American coin, because most all of the coins in that collection, when they were slabbed by PCGS, were condition census number one. They were also condition census number one or two in the half-cent condition census that was kept. And every variety known was included in that, including a variety of which there was only one. And so for a combination of condition and quality, that's a landmark sale that will probably endure forever. I don't think it would be possible to put together.
So if you mix the Pogue of the Pogue coins and the Bob coin to create an ultimate set, I mean, would that ever be, would it be statistically possible to beat that set then?
But say you have the resources and the good fortune of having time on your side, and you combine the best coins from the Pogue set and the Missouri Cabinet set into one mega set. Would it be possible to beat that collection?
You know, it might be statistically possible, but it wouldn't be. It would be very easy and extremely expensive. Part of the advantage of the Missouri Cabinet was that a lot of the coins, and we didn't know that at the time, but a lot of the coins came through the EHR Green collection, which was dispersed when he died back in, it was dispersed in the 40s, and Eric Newman got his pick of the half cents that were in the Green collection, and all of those were remarkably good. And so that became the basis of the Missouri Cabinet. Now, the Missouri Cabinet was a collaboration between Eric Newman and Art Tettenhorst, both of whom were from St. Louis and were business partners. But and Tet added many, many things to it. But the advantage that collection had was that it had a wonderful start back in the 40s. And the additions to it that were made primarily in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even in the after the millennium, really, really made it the star collection that it is or was. It'll be a reference forever for half-cent collectors.
So let's say you finally decided to put some money into a copper coin, and you've never seriously bought copper before. Maybe you have a few junk box pulls, but nothing that you'd say you put any particular thought into. What would a good first coin be, the coin to get you started down the path of really loving your copper collection?
If you had, say, $50 to spend, you could get a fairly low-grade but clean and otherwise wholesome example of a draped bust, a large cent or half cent. These are coins that were made very late in the 1700s or very early in the 1800s. Tremendous history, made when George Washington was president. The last ones made when Thomas Jefferson was president. They have tremendous historical interest. They're very, very pretty. It's a lovely design. And you can get, you know, a decent low-grade wholesome example for $50 or less. If you've got $250 and you want to get a very nice high-grade coin, you can get a very high-grade middle or late-date large cent for that price. You can get a middle or late date half cent for about the same price if you're looking for a type coin. Those are of, you know, greater aesthetic quality because they're of higher grade and they're, and so on, but they don't have quite the history that the earliest ones have. They don't have the charm that the earliest ones have. The earliest ones were made on a screw press. They were struck by hand. The dies were made by hand. Everything about them was made by hand. And so they have this level of charm that, that most other coins don't have, and certainly no modern coin can have.
You know, I know it would cost you a little bit more money, but, you know, but for me, I think that if you really want to give it a shot, there's no coin more exciting to start your journey with than a VF to XF 1794 cent.
Well, I think you're right about that. Those would be, as you say, a little more expensive. Those you're into four figures there, but certainly less than $10,000, more than $1,000, less than $10,000. And yeah, I think once you start collecting mid-grade or high-grade 1794 large cents or half cents, then you're a very serious copper collector already. You don't have to have many.
Yeah, you know, you are seriously invested at that point. You know, I remember as a youngster getting my first Red Book and seeing page after page of these exotic early copper and silver coins before the founding of our country. And then once the mint really starts getting going, you see this beautiful coin with Lady Liberty and a pole and a cat behind her. And I can't think of a more beautiful coin, a more appropriate coin for the period.
I agree with you. In fact, there's a story I could tell. That's actually how I got into early American coppers in the first place. When I was a kid, I bought at a local coin dealer a Liberty Cap large cent that had no date. It was a little corroded, but it had decent detail except that there was no date on it. And I always wondered whether it was ahead of 93, ahead of 94, ahead of 95, and I couldn't tell. And when I was a little older, I joined the ANA, and I checked Sheldon's book out of the ANA library, and I just thought, I want to see if I can figure out what this is. And it took me about 10 or 15 minutes to find out that it was a 1794 Sheldon 29. And by looking a little further, I could find out within a few days when that coin was made, who the designer was, who the coiners were, and so on. There's just fabulous information you can learn. And I just thought, I got to collect these things. And so almost immediately, I joined the AC.
Well, Bill, as always, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to talk to me about these wonderful copper coins.
It's been my pleasure. I'm always happy to talk to you, Charles.
Take care, Bill. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. And remember, you can download all 71 episodes of the Coin Week podcast for free from the iTunes store or stream it online on coinweek.com. For Coin Week, I'm editor Charles Morgan. Until next time, happy collecting.